Mike Shope and the Bulldog.
They have this panther sound effect that is just the cheesiest, stupidest sounding thing. Big voice guy going, "Panther goal scored by Sam Reinhart."
Where'd you get that thing?
I trapped it. Been keeping it in my bathroom at the motel, feeding it old pizza.
It's Mike Shope.
If you're calm, that wondrous big cat will be calm too. But if you're scared, that beautiful death machine will do what God made it to do, namely, eat you with a smile on its face.
And the Bulldog. On WGR, Sports Radio 550.
Pick 10 for the Open Championship later today. I'm up. I don't think I'm going to put Padraig Harrington on my list, but, you know, we love to lose. I'll throw $10 on it. Plus 75,000. $10 to win 7,500. If the most dominant senior player who's won that tournament on that golf course were to win, I don't know. I got $10 for that. Just telling you, I'll be fine if I lose the bet to Brian and Bulldog, but win that. That'll be fine. I'll pay him double. How about that? I'll say it now. With me now on the West Her Hotline is a new guest to the show, Ryan Paganetti. Ryan and I have not spoken before other than on Twitter, and I'm excited to welcome him because he speaks my language, and I flatter myself to say that. Football analytics, Ryan was with the Eagles when they won the Super Bowl with Nick Foles, then Jacksonville, and last year Las Vegas. And Ryan, I'm Mike. Thanks for your time today.
I really appreciate you having me.
You're welcome. So you're not with a team now, but you're building a brand, it seems, online. And ever since I heard your name for the first time last week, I think I've seen it a half a dozen more times since already.
Yeah, I really just kind of went down this direction. And, you know, the quality of life of being, you know, part of an NFL organization or coaching staff can be quite extreme. You know, you're talking in times 110-hour weeks. And, you know, if your team's not very good, I unfortunately was part of a team that wasn't particularly good last year. I sort of wanted to give this a route and open things up to sort of consulting opportunities. And I think there was a perspective I had that was a little bit unique. And basically, I just wanted to give it a shot. And so far, there's been a really incredible reception on it so far.
Yes. I heard you first with Scott Barrett on a podcast a week ago, and you were talking about your time with Doug Peterson and the Eagles. Ryan, how did it start for you?
You know, I started out actually in 2015 with the Eagles, and I just, you know, wanted to get my foot in the door. I was great. You know, I was fortunate to get to be able to get in, and I was able to stick around through a head coaching change. And then Doug Peterson sort of put me in a role where he wanted me to really focus on any kind of numbers or stats to help the coaching staff for the Eagles. And it really kind of took off from there. He had an amazing attitude about using the data. The ownership, Jeffrey Lurie, had an amazing attitude. And my, you know, I was doing the game management stuff during the games and communicating when to go for fourth downs and 2-point conversions. Here's what the numbers say. And in that 5-year stretch I was with them, we ended up going for 25% more fourth downs than any other team and 60% more 2-point conversions. We were leading the league in quarterback sneaks and different things like that. And it was an amazing experience. And it was awesome to, you know, be able to win the Super Bowl with those guys. And I was fortunate that the organization entrusted me in a role to kind of be able to contribute there.
And I was so jealous. I think it was a Bill Barnwell piece that year talking about, was it red, yellow, green? Was that it with Frank Reich and Peterson? And maybe I have the year right.
Yeah. So yeah, we were kind of modifying that over time. And I was always trying to frame things in a way that would really sell it a little bit more on the coaches. So there was the ones that were kind of strong go for it versus the ones that were leaning go. And it started out, I wanted to make sure that we were hitting on all the strong go for it. And as time went on and Peterson was more and more confident with the system, it was, you know, more of that with the strong goes, and he would go for the lean go ones as well. And so it's actually a process that a number of teams around the league have kind of tried to emulate over time. And you've seen the fourth down numbers kind of go through the roof around the league.
At that time in Buffalo, I've been here on the air for more than 25 years. And a lot of those years, the Bills were just mediocre. And it always frustrated me that they would, for instance, they would play New England twice a year, but they would play them as if, you know, they expected to win, not looking for any particular edges like this stuff, you know, not accepting right. the fact that they were underdogs, and they just didn't. They were too proud, I guess. It's not just the Bills. I mean, this is almost all teams. So I begged for a coaching staff, and then you would need ownership probably to come around. And, you know, as you know, this is not – this is percentage – these are percentage plays. It's not just like, you know, Hail Mary stuff. These are percentage plays. So when Philadelphia started to make a name for itself with your involvement doing it, I was just so excited about it. And the question we would ask is, how do you get the coach to sort of – a former player, right, like a lot of coaches, how do you get him to sign off? And you're talking about Peterson like maybe he wasn't that tough a sell.
No, I think what happened is that Jeff, it was clearly organizationally something that Jeffrey Lurie believed in, and a lot of their personnel decisions were sort of instilled on those data-driven principles. Like, go look for a time that the Eagles drafted a running back in Jeffrey Lurie's tenure. I don't even think there's a single time. Like, examples of these analytics arguments showing up on the personnel side, and they would try to advocate on the coaching side. And I think part of the reason it was a little bit easier with Coach Peterson is he was not a victim of his own success, where you have a lot of these veteran head coach play callers that have already won a ton of games in their career, and they're thinking, why am I going to listen to this nerd telling me I'm screwed up? And he had a fresh mindset on you know, handling these situations, and I think it was really productive. And that I don't think I would have had the same success, and I don't think I would have had anywhere near the same buy-in if I had stepped in with a coach that, say, had been in the league for 15 years as a head coach, and then all of a sudden tried to tell him, hey, there's some data saying that you should try this instead.
Yeah, I'm thinking of his contemporary here at the time with the Bills is Rex Ryan. And we talk to Rex every week, but I don't think there was any getting through to him about this. He knew better. Would you go as far as to say, Ryan, if I may ask, that you think you had a role in convincing Peterson to think like this?
I think so. You know, he was so receptive. And as we sort of talked about what the role of me helping during the game would consist of, he's like, whatever you think is best. And I was really hammering him with all these different charts and tables. And Jeffrey Lurie was seeing the same, you know, items. And I think that combination was like, not only is the person that's writing his check giving him the data, but he's seeing that from analysts. He's asking questions. He's wondering if I can modify this. He wants to know exact details of what assumptions are going into this model that explains this. And I think it allowed him to be very comfortable with it, you know, as opposed to some people, their attitude from the analytics is they just say, just go for it. Well, you have to explain exactly why it says go for it. When does it say not go for it? If you're the worst team in the league, does it still say go for it? If you're the best team in the league, you know, and that attitude, I always felt like I was a baseball catcher and I was trying to frame it as well as possible so that he would buy in.
Very cool. Ryan Paganetti with me here on the Western Hotline. I'm Mike Shope. Bulldog is off today. Let's talk about the Philly special, the touchdown before the half against New England in the Super Bowl. I'd love to know, like, you're I'm sure you have a detailed memory of it. I just, as somebody that's always harping on this stuff on my show, like, Collinsworth in the booth before that play, they're just almost incredulous that this is not going to be a field goal attempt, a chip shot field goal. And what happens, I think you'd also, you know, recognize with announcers, if you fail, they're going to talk about it until the end of time. Yep. But if it works, it'll never be mentioned again. Like, it's just next time around, same thing. It's all, why don't you kick? So, I mean, you're not listening to the broadcast at that time, but talk me through sort of like those moments.
Yeah, so what I would say is, you know, we have the exact amount of time remaining effectively and what our timeout situation is, what their timeout situation is. So, you know, leading into a third down call down there, I'm saying, hey, if we get to fourth and two or less, you know, the analytics are going to still say go for it. Fourth and one or less is going to be strong go. And so, you know, we call third down play and we get to whatever was fourth and one and a half or so, and Peterson was going to go for it. And we actually were a little bit, there was like a brief hesitation there as we sort of tried to pick the optimal play. Like, talk about a high leverage situation. Because in that case, the field position is going to be worthless if right. we don't get it, because they can basically just kneel out the half. And so it's a little bit different than if that situation comes up in the first quarter and you don't get it, and all of a sudden they're pinned at the one and you can, you know, it's still an advantage for you for your next drive. So, you know, we were a little bit slow getting a play in. There was a little bit extra thinking. We end up calling a timeout, and Doug's on the sideline calling the plays, and Nick Foles on the field. And Foles comes over, and he communicates to Doug, whatever, and we can't hear upstairs what is going on. We had no idea. And all of a sudden he walks back in, and one of our, you know, I think our quarterback coach upstairs asked Coach Peterson, like, what'd you call? And he goes, Philly special. And I just, my heart dropped a little bit, because all I could think about was, these fans are going to, because the fans had kind of caught on to it that I had this role. It had been brought up in the media. Mm. They're going to blame me if this does not work. Like, I am not going to be allowed back in Philadelphia. It's going to say Ryan Paganetti told them to run a trick play and throw it to Foles, and like some disaster is going to happen. And then I will, I'm like, I swear, I really thought I was never going to be back allowed in Philadelphia. And obviously, you know, the play worked and everyone talks about it, and they did like a TV special on the play. And, but there was probably a 50% chance that that play could have gone entirely different, and the rest of my life would have gone, you know, played out differently.
I mean, I'm not laughing because you're saying any of that lightly. It's just sort of an amazing story. And sports, whether you're in analytics or a player, I mean, it's just so fickle. So you hit that, right. then you go on and win the game too. It wasn't like the game was over at that point. But what a great story. Part of what you've written and talked about is quarterback sneaks. Now, Philadelphia is famous for the tush push, but we're going back before Jalen Hurts, I think, here. We certainly are if we're going back 10 years. What have you found and been able to execute in NFL front offices in terms of the quarterback sneak? Is it something that might still be something you'd consider underutilized?
I would say in general, yes, it is still underutilized, but the usage has exploded. So in the year 2016, there was less than 70 sneaks in the entire league, and in this last year, there was about 340. It's really incredible when you think about it. But I grew up in Massachusetts. I went to a ton of New England games. I watched them play the Bills, and you know, unfortunately, they beat up on the Bills a number of times. I was always growing up blown away by how more teams were not copying the Patriots. And you know, Tom didn't have the most, you know, ideal body for quarterback sneaks, but he was leading the league in sneaks almost every single year. And there was a period of time he had double the rest of the league for a decade. And so I spent that 2017 offseason really kind of finding the bottlenecks with each individual coach. Why are we not using this play? Because my first year with Peterson, we ran one or two sneaks the whole year. And some of these concerns that they had, when you actually looked at the data, they say, oh, you can only do it when it's under a yard. You can only do it when there's an open A gap. And when actually testing these things with as much data as possible, and we had to manually tag things and study all these different metrics, it was very clear that teams they should be just sneaking anyways. Like, it doesn't really matter what the defense is. And, some people were concerned about quarterback injuries. The quarterback injury rate was astronomically low on those plays.
Yep.
And we tried to take those variables and think like, okay, let's capitalize on this. And we had a big quarterback. We invested in the line. We had Brandon Brooks and Lane Johnson and, you know, Jason Kelce was like at the record for most sneaks ever now for centers. And they believed in it and they liked it. You know, we started doing it and the fans got involved. And I think we, in that 2017 season, we converted every time. And over time that has evolved into sort of two worlds. There's the normal quarterback sneaks, and then there's these rugby scrum tush push sneaks. And I've mentioned it online. I actually prefer the Buffalo version where you line up in a semi-believable formation because people are coming up with solutions to stopping these rugby scrum looks. They're like dive bombing really low. They're having these tactical strategies of how they're hitting certain linemen, and there's like an overlap player behind. And there's very few other things that you can do from that alignment. When you're in the Buffalo version, you at least have the upside to run other plays because, you know, they have receivers out there. It looks plausible that they could do something else, even if they end up running sneaks at, you know, one of the league highest rates.
70 quarterback sneaks 10 years ago to over 300. I wonder what percentage of that 300 or 300 plus last year, Ryan, is not even run by quarterbacks. I think like Mark Andrews running all the Baltimore sneaks, you know, as a tight end, and other teams, maybe even Goddard once or twice. I know they have Hurts, but you know, why not?
I'll give you a number. There was 46 non-quarterback sneaks, non-quarterback, but yes, sneaks last year, which was the most I have ever seen. You know, Seattle won the Super Bowl. It didn't come up in the Super Bowl. They had been doing it with the tight end. So a few different teams decided that either from a quarterback health standpoint or just from a preference standpoint that they were going to go down that route. I'd say for a team like Buffalo, they don't necessarily need to do that because Josh is so good at them, and yeah, he almost has the body of a tight end.
Now, you have pointed out that there is an element of predictability, which might be putting it mildly, to the Bills' sneak attack, so to speak.
Yes. So you know, obviously there was that unbelievably unfortunate situation for Bills fans where they lost the AFC Championship game. They actually had four sneak stops in the game. There was three of them on offense, defense, and then one was a two-point conversion when Josh basically threw it to, like, Curtis Samuel or somebody after he wasn't going to get it. So they really lost. He failed on four of them. But, you know, after the game, the Chiefs, one of the Chiefs players mentioned they had a 10-for-10 streak going to the left. And I watched every sneak every week in my time in the NFL, and I knew that number was way more than 10. So this last couple weeks, I actually went through, and from 2022, about week 10, through this last, you know, through the AFC, up until the AFC Championship game, they had run left 70 consecutive times on their sneaks, which is almost unbelievably incomprehensible. However, they were excellent doing so. So, like, I think, and then going into that game, the Chiefs had failed to stop 32 consecutive quarterback sneaks. So I totally understand the approach and the attitude. Now, the Chiefs did an amazing job game plan-wise. They clearly knew it was going left. They did some interesting things. They had an extra defensive lineman over there at times. The off-ball players would immediately start running left. You know, that I honestly think that last quarterback sneak that Josh got, quote-unquote, stopped on, I really think he converted it.
Yep.
And, you know, it's unbelievable to think. He converts that, I think they're more than likely to win that game in terms of from that moment on, and then they're more than likely to be favored in the Super Bowl. And, you know, I know Bills fans maybe don't want to hear that because it's, like, painful, but it just shows you the margins of how close these things are.
Right.
And, you know, since then, Buffalo, obviously they're aware of the situation. They have some other versions here. They're not going to go left every single time. But from my understanding, part of that left tendency was basically the right-handed nature of the center was that he's using his right hand to snap it, so having his left arm immediately available makes it so that it was easier for him to basically go left and either block a left A-gap defender or on the nose tackle. They would double-team the nose tackle with the right guard and the left and the center, so he would take the left part of that nose tackle and the right guard would take the right part of his body part. And that, I think, was I kind of an under-discussed part of that. I've talked to a couple of different centers who at least believe that's the case.
Interesting. Ryan, so much good information here. I know you've recently unearthed stats about whether coordinators should be on the field or in the booth or play callers either side of the ball. Let's spend a minute on that. I mean, it sounds like or reads like just a ton of time went into being able to, you know, use all these examples and come up with some interesting information.
Yeah, so I had somebody who's got a really huge following on social media bring up the question, and a bunch of people tagged me, and they said, you know, Ryan Pagnetti needs to look into this, and I kind of tried to do a deep dive, and to the best of my ability, I attempted to assess where the play caller was, and I think that I think by the end of it, I had 20 years, and I felt about 99% good of the ones that I had. There were some that were a little bit of a mystery, but the interesting kind of nuance was there seemed to be a boost, even if you remove play calling head coaches, for the play caller to be on the sideline. And I think part of that, just from being in coaching booths for a long time, is the discussions that can take place between the head coach and the quarterback, the play caller, the head coach, the quarterback, the offensive line, all these different parties on the sideline. It's a real big hassle for the play calling offensive coordinator to speak to the quarterback between drives when he's upstairs. You have to basically use a phone, and it's like very cumbersome, and it's like you're living in the Stone Age to do so. And I think that could be kind of a key layer there. Now, the margin is quite small, and there's some coordinators that clearly prefer being up or down, and I think, like, you know, it doesn't really matter where you are, you know, if you clearly have a preference. But it was some interesting data regardless that I thought was, you know, it's the type of thing that I'm hoping to bring the fans that, you know, people will find engaging.
Very cool. Just a couple minutes left here with you, Ryan. What's next in this world with all the transformation teams figuring it out when it comes to fourth down and two-point plays? Not everybody's there on the down eight, go for two stuff yet. I mean, we're not quite
right.
It's not unanimous yet. It still baffles the likes of Troy Aikman, which I find hilarious. Why would they do that? You know what? Open one book and find out. Sorry, getting on a tangent here. But what are a couple things maybe where teams haven't figured out yet that there's an edge, if you know?
I think, you know, you still run into some scenarios where these teams are getting a little too drop back heavy, particularly early on in the games. And for everyone who talks about run pass balance, I think there's even more importance to play action and run balance. Like it's very highly correlated that the teams that are running a lot of play action are having, you know, more success both on those play action passes, and it gives a little bit of a boost to your run game, because every time that there's a mesh with the running back, these defenses have to respect it more. If 80% of the time that there's a mesh with the running back, the ball's being handed off, like that, you know, you get linebackers and second level defenders being able to play downhill more. I think that's going to be a narrative that it continues to exist. Clint Kubiak just won the Super Bowl. They were a heavy play action team. Sean McVay's a heavy play action team. I think it's going to be something that people keep an eye on. The other one that's just totally it's insane is the long field goal attempts ever since they changed the K balls. So they changed the K ball process this past year. It allowed the teams to work on the ball a lot more. Mm-hmm. And you saw 74 55 plus yard field goals. The previous year was something like 54, and it wasn't just 55 pluses. I was on the wrong side of it. You know, I know Cam Little well. I actually worked with him, but Cam Little set the all-time NFL record against the Raiders before halftime. He went 68 yards. And these numbers are, like, insane. You know, if you said this to somebody 15 years ago, they're like, what are you talking about? Did they just allow steroids? Like, it's unbelievable. But the number that kind of shocked some people is that in the year 2000, there was one total 55-plus yard field goal in the entire NFL. This last year, 74. And so you start it's just really it's just wild. And you're talking, you have to handle your end of half and end of game situations significantly different, because you're the Bills in the playoffs. You're playing Cam Little and the Jaguars, and Bills fans are sweating. If these guys get to the 50, this game might go to overtime. Like, that is like a legitimate concern. You know, I don't remember whether the score was three-point margin or four-point margin at the time, I forget. But that's just like an example of the considerations you have to make that really weren't a thing even a couple of years ago.
Sure. Consider that, plus what they've done with touchbacks, trying to find the happy medium there. And it can be like two good plays put you in field goal range from a touchback.
Right, right.
Love the point about play action. When Brian Daboll was here, he got a lot of credit for that. Play action in motion all the time, and like cheat codes, you know? And I remember too, and I really liked Micah Hyde, the Bills safety, who was on with us, I think maybe for 2 years every week, at least one. And I was so immersed in all of that one time I brought up to him, hey, Micah, have you ever sort of read anything on or heard any coach talk about how like play action from an offense, really just there's no reason not to do it? And he's like, come on, no. Of course not. Don't be stupid, you know, like that. But, you know, it seems like an automatic win on any given play for an offense. Maybe you can't always do it. I don't know. But why not? What's it costing you to run somebody across the box? All right. Anyway, Ryan, I've really enjoyed this. It's good to know you, and I'll be reading your work for sure.
Yeah, I'd say for sure it's an exciting time for Bills fans. You know, the team's a great team. Every year they're contenders. I'm a believer in Joe Brady. I think he's got an exceptional offensive scheme. I've long thought that Jim Leonard is an incredibly intriguing defensive coordinator, because his production in college in particular was really, really strong. So I'll be keeping an eye on their team. And obviously, you know, I think at some point here soon, they're going to finally break through.
Very good. Well, again, I'll be following you. If I can do anything for you, let me know.
Thank you.
Ryan Paganetti, my guest here on the Wester Hotline, talking about some fun last decade or so history with football analytics. The field goal point is interesting. The sneaks, can you believe that? That the Bills ran 70 consecutive quarterback sneaks to the left side in a span of 2.5 seasons. Did you even notice it? Until the Chiefs called them out on it after beating them. I never noticed it. So there's always the next thing. Any of that of interest to you? 803-0550. We can talk some more about it. England takes the lead over Argentina at the World Cup. 65th minute. England looking to get to the final. 1-0. I'm Mike Shope, and this is WGR.
We end up calling a timeout, and Doug's on the sideline calling the plays, and Nick Foles on the field. And Foles comes over, and he communicates to Doug, whatever. We can't hear upstairs what is going on. We had no idea. And all of a sudden he walks back in, and one of our, you know, I think our quarterback coach upstairs asked Coach Peterson, like, what'd you call? And he goes, Philly special. And my heart dropped a little bit, because all I could think about was, these fans, they're going to blame me if this does not work. Like, I'm not going to be allowed back in Philadelphia. It's going to say Ryan Paganetti told them to run a trick play and throw it to Foles, and, like, some disaster is going to happen. And then I'm like, I swear, I really thought I was never going to be back allowed in Philadelphia.
So good. Ryan Paganetti is the name. That's his Twitter handle, too. How about that? I mean, I am no Eagles fan, but, well, they were playing New England. And you win my heart with stuff like that. Just, it's so easy to rip on a trick play that doesn't work. And it's not like that can't ever be appropriate. But it's always too cute. It's almost like cute should be good. But if it's too cute, then it's bad. Cute can stand. Too cute is the problem. And it just will always be the same, I think. Maybe it's already happened. I don't know. More and more teams getting creative. How about creative instead of cute? Because creative is good, right? Do we have to use a word that we know is insulting? Creative is good. Maybe it's already changed in this way, but look out if, whether you're an analytics director or a head coach or anybody else, calling a play, unconventional play, in a big spot, if it doesn't work. If it does, we'll never even think about it twice. Unless it's, you know, like that is legendary. I mean, that's fourth down in the Super Bowl, throwing a pass to the quarterback. I mean, it has it all. That one has it all. And, you know, like Ryan said, it didn't have to work, but it did, and it worked pretty easily. I mean, Foles, if you remember the play from Trey Burton, he's the tight end who throws the pass, and Foles is just alone, walks into the end zone on that play. Really good stuff. But the ones that fail, we have a DeMar Hamlin fake punt against the Chiefs in the playoffs that maybe we would not even remember if the Bills could have won that game, and they certainly had chances to later on. But, you know, failed trick plays kind of live forever. And only the very best and biggest of the trick plays that work also do. Hook and ladder, Miami-San Diego, and this one, and I'm sure a few others. 803-0550 for your calls. Did you like that? I mean, Ryan has had a very interesting career, and I'm just getting to know who he is and loved having a chance to sit with him here for the last 20 minutes or so. Just before we started talking, the top tweet on my feed is from Travis Yost, and it's a picture of a gas tank where the gas is 90 cents a gallon. And he tweets, if you follow Travis, you can see it. He tweets, at Gas Buddy, should I disclose location? Where is this gas tank where the gas is, I mean, of course, like mispriced, probably anyway, at 90 cents a gallon? And so I'm like, I see that. I'm like, who is Gas Buddy? So I run the cursor over the Twitter handle, Gas Buddy. And you know how it says, like, followed by people that maybe you follow? And so there's that. And it says, followed by this person, and three others that you follow. So now I click on that to see who is following Gas Buddy. And the first name is Barry Bonds. I think the premise here is where you can maybe find out about locations where gas is cheaper. I think, right? Wouldn't that be the point? What do I need Gas Buddy for? What does Gas Buddy say about itself? Gas Buddy helps you save money on gas. All right, well, that works. That holds up. So, Barry, what is Barry Bonds up to? Well, for one thing, he's following Gas Buddy. He might say that he doesn't know if he's asked. He might say, I didn't know I was following Gas Buddy. I don't need to worry about the price of gas. I'm Barry Bonds. I was thinking about him for a minute. Really, the point isn't going to be about Barry Bonds because I don't want to lose you. But like a week ago when I was off, after, I think maybe, or maybe it was after I was here, it doesn't matter. But recently, one day I was talking about, again, how much I hate instant replay. And in this World Cup, which has been so fabulous, you still have these very sketchy decisions and really just, we can't review all fouls, which is good because that would be insufferable. But if it's a yellow card, we can review it. And we had the one in the game with Argentina and Switzerland where the yellow card was overturned, and because they caught the other guy diving, they gave him a yellow, which meant he would get a red card and be thrown out, and all of this just because we have replay. And as ever, there are people who say that that's all good. He took a dive. Why shouldn't he have gotten a card? But there are just, it's because of the same logic that I use talking about the NFL. It's because there are just dozens of plays in every game that you could do where you could do the same thing. Most of them we probably don't even have replays of. If they do, they might not even want to show them because all it does is make the refs and the league look bad. So I just think if you're picking and choosing those, it's just an endless frustration, and you're not really getting it right any more often, in my mind. I mean, maybe one play, but all the ones you're missing really don't deserve to be overlooked. So it's just like sort of a simple logic point for me about replay. For the number of times when you don't think twice about it and a call is overturned, often even though it doesn't look like it should be, right? How many times, even in this World Cup, do you have the officiating expert come on? I heard it recently in a game when I was driving. That's not a penalty, and then it was. So you can't even get the foremost experts in officiating to agree. That happens all the time in the NFL. I mean, all the time. Then it's got to be clear and obvious and all of this. So how is this about Barry Bonds? Somebody pushed back at me, a few people did, about this replay point, and it's just such an eye roll every time. Like, don't you get it? Come on, don't you get it? They don't get it. And somebody brought up Armando Galarraga's non-perfect game for the Tigers. This was, I think, in 2010. And how, you know, again, a bad, this is always, it's always the same. Well, what about that? A bad call deprived him of a perfect game. Quick. Name for me anybody that's thrown a perfect game in the last 20 years. Quick. Well, if you're me, you can't do that. I can't think of anybody. But I know of Armando Galarraga because of that play. So he doesn't throw a perfect game, but it's almost better because everybody thinks he deserved it. And what? How different is his life? He knows that he deserved it. So, I mean, he might as well claim it. There's no perfect game society, right, where he gets to go to a country club once a year and celebrate each other's. He's not. If they had that, he'd be invited anyway, probably. He'd be allowed in. I mean, there's no practical benefit. I mean, you know in your mind that you did it, you know? Even without the instant replay there to save us all. And, you know, I think when I think about that point, I think about like Andre Reed and, okay, Barry Bonds and guys who, for different reasons, I mean, Reed is now in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but for many years was not. And I would always say about that, I mean, I hope nobody would take offense to this, or Andre Reed himself wouldn't take offense to this, I hope. But the longer he goes as somebody that gets talked about every year, about whether they deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, kind of like the better for him if he wants to monetize it or if he's, you know, if fame is the point. Now, that's different than the perfect game point because that Hall of Fame is a club and you want to be in the club. But when have we ever talked about Andre Reed since he got into the Hall of Fame? You know, Bills trivia and stuff. He's a Bills legend. But in terms of the league, like once you get in, that's kind of it. There's no more real, there's no next thing. You get in and that's it. And Bonds, I mean, this is really not, last point, this is really not still happening because Bonds is his own subject, Bonds and Clemens. But for a long time, if not still, the debate is should they be in the Hall of Fame? And, you know, they're not, and maybe they'll never make it. But once they do, that's the end of that. Then he's just a stat, you know? Then he's just a memory. Not to be cold about it, but there is value in being the exception. There's value in the guy who didn't get the call. So I went a long way with the replay into that, or maybe the other way around, but that's where my thoughts went. Here's Dave with us. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for taking my call. This is kind of a convoluted question, but about the Bills. Last season, they seem to always have poor first halves and good second halves. it's as if they made adjustments. So I know the league doesn't have a salary cap for coaches. Could they add coaching staff to review in real time and make adjustments on the fly?
Well, I would think that they would probably tell you that they already do that. And I wouldn't dare to tell you different. Just a matter of whether it works out. One thing myself I don't think about the Bills is that they have too few coaches. I think it's ridiculous almost how many, not ridiculous, I mean, I'm sure they all have their purposes, but how many do we really need? I mean, the position coaches have assistants, and they might even have their own assistants, and all the different, we just talked to an analytics guy, there's lots of those people. I mean, it's dozens on staffs now. And I would probably say, not to sound like maybe they would sound when answering such a question, I mean, if you're asking the Bills this question, they would say, we believe in our people, so you're not asking the Bills, you're asking me. Without any judgment on their people, I think there would come a point where it's too many. Too many chefs, too many cooks, too many voices, too much noise. So I don't think it's a matter probably of too few people. I think it's a matter of having the right ones and those people making the right decisions. So I don't know. That's not how I would think to try to fix that. I think what you said is mostly true, though, about last year. I don't know if it's every year. And by the way, I'm not sure it even matters anymore because the head coach is out. New defensive coordinator. Whatever it means to have Joe Brady in a greater position, still the play caller. I do love a team that can get out early, though. Like I've said many times, comebacks get all the glory. But it's way better for your chances of winning to be the team that gets out in front early. You don't want to have to live playing from behind all the time. Get the lead, dictate the game, make the other team have to chase you is better than the other way around. But comebacks are so glorified. Oh, the heart. One thing I got to say about this group, they did not quit. Nobody quits. It's just great. Thanks. You don't even need to say it. Get the lead. That's a sign. I'm not taking this to Dave's idea that it's not because they don't have enough coaches. But I think how coaches script plays, how offensive coaches tend to script plays, I would guess that Brady does this, but I guess I don't know for sure. I think we've talked about this with him, that is one strong indicator of good coaching is if, this is again back to a conversation we had with Warren Sharp on the show a couple of weeks ago, that you're really on it. When you can come out with plays that keep your opponent on their heels, that's a good sign for your team. It's a good sign for your coach. Third quarter is good too. We are 1-1 at the World Cup. Still plenty of time for this goal that I didn't really even see to be overturned. So, remember, when you're watching sports, don't enjoy yourself in these moments. You got to wait. Make sure it's allowed to count. Argentina is celebrating, as are their fans. It's 1-1. We'll see if it remains that. Late, by the way, in Atlanta, 86th minute. Winner gets Spain in the final on Sunday in New York, and they might have orange skies like we have today. 803-0550 for your calls. We'll talk some golf with Brian Koziol and the Open Championship starting tomorrow. That'll be at 5:30. Lines open until then. This is Mike Shope on WGR.